Just as the upcoming climate change conference in Paris will try to make concrete progress on a seemingly intractable problem, this week in Chicago, I got a chance to see a similar attempt on a smaller scale at the Chicago Disability Inclusion and Opportunity Summit. It was part of the 25th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act commemoration. And if that sounds like a generic do-gooder event with chicken for lunch and a polite wine reception, let me correct the impression. Hundreds of people in education and government, industry, and the rehabilitation field were gathered to attack the frustrating reality that the unemployment rate for employable people with disabilities has remained at about 66% for the past 25 years. Further, recent research at Rutgers and Syracuse universities shows that the stigma of disability remains strong, comparing the responses to applications from fictitious candidates for thousands of accounting jobs. Disclosing a disability on your application meant employers were 26% less likely to express an interest in you. Democratic Governor of Delaware, Jack Markell, has led a national effort to get states to deal with this. He told me it's about getting out and actually hiring people rather than waiting for things to change on their own.
About probably 15 years ago now, I visited one of our great employers who employ a lot of people with disabilities, and I met a young man. He was about 25 years old. He had Down syndrome, and he was making T-shirts, and he was extraordinarily excited to have this job, and he told me all about it. And I asked him, I said, what did you do before you had this job? And he said, I sat at home for 6 years watching TV with my parents. I mean, it was one of those, you know, there aren't that many moments in life when you have an epiphany. That was one of those moments where, frankly, I had an epiphany. And I realized the profound improvement in his quality of life, that he, every morning, had a reason to get up. He had a purpose to get dressed, you know, to get transportation to the office. He was part of a team. He was part of something that was bigger than himself. And he earned a paycheck. And I also thought about the amazing improvement in the quality of life of his family. So that was actually the impetus for my initiative. And I always had in the back of my mind, I said, you know, if I have an opportunity to impact an issue at a national level, I think I'm going to do that. And when I became chair of the National Governors Association, there's an organization called the National Governors Association. Every year there's a chair. There are no particular perks that go with the job, but what you do get to do is every chair gets to choose one issue for the whole, all the governors to focus on. And so my political advisors said at the time, they said, I told them what I was planning to do. They said, don't do that issue. You know, do, you know, small business growth or do education reform. Do something big. And I said, this is huge. You don't understand that there are like tens and tens and tens of millions of people in this country who what they want to do is they want to work, and nobody ever gives them a shot. And by the way, they're Democrats and they're Republicans alike.
What you find often is that when strategies in employment are focused on individual employees, custom fitting jobs and making accommodations for individual employees, what it reveals is that the job as it stands and the company as it stands is basically a slave to habits that they've had for 20 and 30 years, and that the procedure has never been, the process, the manufacturing process has never been designed for anyone,
right,
let alone people with disabilities, and so you suddenly get that boost.
You do, and that, of course, is a very difficult thing to change because people get very tied into how they've always done business and, you know, getting them to redesign their processes. And again, the ultimate benefit of redesigning your processes is not just to help people with disabilities. It's probably going to make your whole company better.
And customization is the buzzword now. I mean, all whether you're talking about customer service, whether you're talking about custom manufacturing so that people can get the device they want with the color they want and the weight they want and the features they want, you know, these are issues that are throughout business right now.
Yeah.
How do you change minds? How do you get people actually to have paychecks as opposed to memos and conferences and, you know, all the sort of symbolic ceremonials that go with something like this?
You know, somebody has to be a pioneer in every community. Let me give you a specific example. About 4 or 5 years ago, I read an entry on one of the New York Times blogs about a guy in Denmark whose son had been diagnosed with autism when he was about 2. This guy was on the fast track in the IT industry in Denmark. And it really was not in his life's plan to have a son with autism. And the more he learned about autism, the more concerned he was about his son having any kind of a decent future. So the guy quit his job And he decided he was going to build an enterprise to help people with on the autism spectrum get jobs in the technology field. And there are a lot of people with on the autism spectrum who can do really great work in the technology field. So to make a long story short, I read about this guy. I called him, and he now lives in Delaware with his family, including his son with autism. And I introduced him to about 10 or 12 business leaders in my state, technology leaders. And one of those technology leaders said, "This is very interesting." He went to Denmark just to do a little due diligence. And we've now created this program, and so far they've trained about 55 people with autism who are either working full-time for sort of third-party employers or are working full-time for the Delaware IT company on behalf of external customers. Somebody had to take that chance, and it's not that big a risk. It's just not that big a risk.
What is the issue of preparation for an employment setting that is, A, the responsibility of employers to think about, yeah, and, B, the responsibility of people with disabilities to come ready to work?
Well, and a lot of depends upon the individual people. But, I mean, you know, do you need some kind of coach? Now, I think, if I remember correctly, in the case of the Walgreens Distribution Center that I visited in Connecticut, for 200, there are 500 employees, half of them have disabilities, and I think they had two coaches. You know, not every organization is big enough to be able to afford two coaches. But that being said, you can still get people ready, and you can explain sort of here's how we're doing things differently, and here might be, you know, these folks might need a little extra time to do this, or they might need a little assistance here, but it's going to make us stronger as a company. And so I think it's incumbent upon all of us, including the leaders of the business organizations, those of us in government, those in foundations, to make sure that that's the understanding and that's a presumption going in.
Jack Markell is second-term Democratic governor of Delaware. I spoke to him in Chicago as part of the Disability Inclusion Opportunity Summit. Coming up, a big private insurer says it wants to bail on Obamacare as a money loser. What's your verdict on the Affordable Care Act?
This is Martin Edengard from Beaverton, Oregon. The Affordable Care Act has given several friends of mine access to affordable health care and peace of mind that they would not have otherwise had.
Boca Raton, Florida. My 26-year-old is on it now, and it's very expensive, and there's still a lot to cover out of pocket. Miami, Florida. More than anything, it forced a conversation in our house about what actually constitutes a luxury. For years, my mom would say about doctor's appointments, "Not everyone gets to have these, you know." And for the first time, I was able to say, "But they should." Tell us a story. 877-8-MY-TAKE is our number. Much more at thetakeaway.org. Less than a decade after President George H.W. Bush signed the ADA in 1990, the Supreme Court issued a landmark ruling in the case of Olmstead versus L.C. It was a majority opinion of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg that declared that states must do everything in their power to integrate citizens with intellectual disabilities rather than segregating them in institutions. 16 years after the Olmstead ruling, a new investigation from the Minneapolis Star Tribune finds that little has changed for people with disabilities in the land of 10,000 lakes, anyway. Joining us is Chris Sears, reporter with the Minneapolis Star Tribune. What did you expect the changes to be, Chris, and what was the intent of the law that would give you an indication of what you were looking for?
Well, the intent of the law was that people with disabilities should have the same opportunities as people without disabilities. What we found in Minnesota is that 16 years had passed since this landmark ruling, and Minnesota had yet to even create a plan to actualize what was in that ruling. And we had thousands, and we still do, we have thousands of people in segregated facilities all over our state.
Let's hear the voice of Scott Rood, who's in his early 30s. He has Down syndrome, and he does have a job, and he spoke to one of your reporters.
You pick up garbage, pretty much, and you just put it in bags. Garbage is always part bad for the environment. The reason I'm working there is trying to get into a community job.
Now, certainly there's no reason to believe that Scott is doing anything other than working as hard as he can, but he represents an employee in the sheltered workshop industry. Can you explain how that either does or does not represent the goal of the Olmstead ruling?
Right. So Scott is one of 12,000 people across our state that works in one of these sheltered workshops. And these are facilities where, you know, they bring people in with disabilities and they do menial tasks, and they're paid on a piecemeal basis, which means they're paid based on how quickly they do the work, and they're measured against people without disabilities. So if they only do the work half as fast as you or I would do the work, then they're paid half as much as you or I would be paid. And in some cases, we came across people that were paid 50 cents or a dollar an hour. And so it's discriminatory by its very nature. But the idea was, is they were supposed to transition to regular jobs in the community. They weren't supposed to be dead-end jobs that they would spend the rest of their lives working in. We met people who had been in state mental institutions, you know, 40 years ago, who were stuck on the same assembly lines that they were working on for the past four decades. As part of our series, we went to Vermont. Vermont has adopted a radically inclusive model of care for people with disabilities, and they've been remarkably successful. You know, their rate of employment for people with disabilities is the top in the nation. Vermont, back in 2001, decided they would stop all state funding of sheltered workshops. They would end it, no more. And 80% of the people that used to work in those workshops now have jobs in the community. They're making at least minimum wage.
What have you discovered has been the result of the group home program, which was used to deinstitutionalize so many people after the Olmstead ruling?
Well, group homes have a place. You know, there's no question that some people with severe disabilities and mental illnesses do need 24-hour care 7 days a week, which is supposed to be the reason for group homes. But what we found is that in many cases, people who were in group homes didn't actually need that level of care, and they could live in the community if they had supports to do so. And what we also found is that in many cases, at least in our state, people were sent hundreds of miles away from their home communities, from their families, from their loved ones, from their support networks, and they were sent to the far northern regions of our state to these isolated group homes in the woods, in the swamps.
Chris Sears is a reporter with the Minneapolis Star Tribune looking at the lack of success despite 16 years on since the Olmstead versus LC case landmark decision. Chris, thanks so much.
Thank you.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.